The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Greetings, people of Earth. It's 11:02 on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 on the West Coast, and 10:02 in the Central Time Zone where I'm sitting here in Northeast Minneapolis. Welcome to this, another edition of Jim Peters at Night. I'm Jim Peters. This is our 22nd episode. We've been doing this now for 7 weeks. We have a doozy of a show for you tonight. Our guest is Dr. Patrick Moore, former co-founder of Greenpeace, a climatologist. He wrote a fantastic book. I'm going to put it on the screen here because I'm learning how to do this shit. I can learn. I'm a learner. Here you go. There's his book. It's called Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. And we're going to talk about it. We taped this early this morning. Fabulous interview. Fabulous guy. Now, I strongly recommend you buy and read this book. We're going to put a link to it in our blog. Matter of fact, I've given about half a dozen copies to all sorts of different people because in 200 pages, Mr. Moore says in no uncertain terms and extremely scientifically based, I complimented him during the interview. You'll hear this about the fact that he made an extremely complex subject as simple as possible, but it's still not that simple. But he basically debunks the whole goddamn thing. It's like, and once again, I've said this before too, it's not that climate change, or at least what they refer to colloquially as climate change, it actually isn't. But what they call climate change, the fact that the Earth is warming up, yes, that's true. No one's disputing that. The question is, are there ramifications to this in the future? And he says absolutely not. As a matter of fact, if anything, he's one of the growing number of scientists who says it's actually a positive for the planet, because the problem is that the climate change advocates, the people that have been pushing this, basically are trying to equate CO2, carbon dioxide, with pollution, and nothing could be further from the truth. They're completely separate, totally. I'm not going to go on anymore. You got to hear this interview because he's fabulous, and it's the second time I've interviewed this guy. We talked for an hour. So we got that. So what's going on otherwise here? I'll tell you. Hold on. What's going on, that is, next Wednesday is the second Republican primary debate. Not on Fox News. It's actually going to be on Fox Business, although I think Fox News is simulcasting it, I think, if I'm right. So as we did though for the first debate, we're going to go live as soon as it's done, which is scheduled to be about 10 p.m. Central Time. So it is basically going to be our normal starting time. Whenever it ends, we're going up. I already got a guest booked for that night. I'm trying to get another one, maybe a little panel discussion. You guys can call in and join in with us. We're going to talk about what happened. Like the last show, too, I don't think it'll be that long. My guess is maybe it will be about an hour. Seriously, how much can you talk about this crap? At this point, we almost pretty much know what they're going to say, you know. The only real surprise here in the last week or so, Nikki Haley has risen in the polls even further. There's some polls that now say she's second behind Trump rather than DeSantis. Matter of fact, I saw a poll today that actually put DeSantis at fifth. Mr. DeSantis is not having a good run at this, which is unfortunate, because my problem is, all right, so we're going to, you know, they're going to talk and they're going to present and all that sort of crap. At this point in my life, I do not care what politicians say. Now, if you listen to any of my radio shows or podcasts previously, you've noticed something. I virtually never have actual sitting politicians on the show. You know why? Because all they'll say is shit that will get them elected. They will say what they will lie through their teeth just to get elected or get score some points. And as an interviewer, why do I want to hear that? Well, I don't. There's one exception in the 3 years I've been doing this so far, not this show, but the previous shows. I had on one guy who was a state senator here in Minnesota to address the fact that there are counties in Wisconsin. There were counties in Minnesota that wanted to succeed and join Wisconsin, which happened. I think that's still ongoing in Oregon. Here, nobody really took it that seriously. And also, that was another reason to put him on. It was kind of sort of a goof, but still, there was serious legislation floating around about this. So, guy's name, if I'm right, it was Jeremy Munson, I think. He's a public figure, so don't mind naming him. You'll notice there's a lot of people that I won't name because I know they don't want to be associated with this debacle. I even told my story yet again to Dr. Moore, you'll hear on the interview, about how I went to that scientific convention about 10 years ago and ran into a really famous climatologist, and we both basically got drunk at the bar, and he told me climate change was complete utter bullshit. And that's when I was starting to suspect that for a long time, but when I heard him say it in a 20-minute diatribe, basically kind of a little in the half of the bag, then I realized, no, I'm not fooling myself here. This guy knows, and Dr. Moore agreed with me. This man told me the only reason anybody pays any attention to climate change, all these climate change bullshit artists, is that it's the only way right now you can get any funding for any of your projects. And Dr. Moore concurred. Right now, if you don't agree that climate change is an existential threat, you won't get any money for anything you're doing. That's the deal. This is the single biggest political grift that's been, maybe not in modern times, maybe even in the history of this country. They have everybody convinced that this is a real thing, and it isn't. And so you listen to this interview, and then I highly recommend you buy Dr. Moore's book. We don't even have an Amazon affiliation set up yet, so we're not making any money off of pushing this thing. I just think you as a citizen should read this. It's not very long. He's an excellent writer. He did as good a job as anybody can do explaining a really, really complex subject in very simple terms. No, not very simple. I'll say relatively simple. Okay? And then what else happened today? This is one of those days where the news is kind of depressing. I got two things I want to talk about here before we start the interview. And they're not going to take very long because I want to get into this. First of all, 470,000 Venezuelans were given temporary work status by the Biden administration today. That's almost 500,000 people. And you have to be clear about this. You might have heard about this in the news, but it's kind of glossed over. It's not like 500,000 people that came over the border. It's specifically people who came from Venezuela. I don't know why that is, why they made that distinction, but it is. Maybe it's because they had to make a distinction. I don't know. But anyway, all these 470,000 people, they're all here illegally. They all busted in the country illegally. They're getting temporary work visas and along with that, Social Security numbers. And there's a lot of states in the United States where if you have a Social Security number, you can either register to vote or you can get a driver's license and then you can register to vote. That's crazy. And, you know, I've been saying this for 3 years now, or actually 2 years. I've been saying for 2 years that this is a deliberate ploy among the Democrats to increase the voting rolls in their favor. And you know something? At this point, they're basically not even trying to hide it anymore. They aren't. And once again, a conspiracy theory that everyone would say I was crazy about, I'm right about again. It's like, this is... And not only that, Biden did this by executive fiat. There's no vote in Congress, nothing. He just did it. So he is solely responsible for this. Meanwhile, today, just today, in the last 24 hours, 10,000 people came over the border in Texas and got let into the United States. Like I said, they're not even pretending anymore. Basically, they're just letting people in, you know? So the estimate is that by the end of Biden's term next year, by Election Day, there will be about 77 million people would have crossed into the United States illegally. And that, ladies and germs, is 2% of the American population. So our elections are pretty close already. You know, if 200, if 90% of those people were all got, if they all got voting rights, and 90% of those people decided to vote Democratic because Joe Biden did them a favor, it could easily tip an election, and that's why they're doing it. That's the reason. It has nothing to do with humanity. And no matter of fact, if anything, it's inhumane what they're doing. Too many people. There's too many murders coming around. Too many kids without adults or parent supervision. It's just, it's a debacle. And the other thing is, and this gets to my second story tonight, if you only a certain number of conservative news outlets are basically covering this. Although I do have to say, that's changing. And this is kind of really interesting. CNN, for the first time, is starting to cover this. The other thing that's happened in the last week or so, and I made allusion to this, I think, last Thursday, is that the mainstream press, which has been covering for Biden since this whole, you know, since he started running for campaign for president from his basement, they've been covering for him, they're starting to bitch and moan about his performance all of a sudden. There's an article in the New York Times today about the UN meeting that he was at, which was highly unflattering to him. I mean, and at this point, they're starting to call him out. Now, I don't know if you saw any of this footage. He gave a speech at the UN in front of the General Assembly where basically about one quarter of it was unintelligible because he can't talk. He's mumbling, and you can't even make out what he's trying to say. Then he did another thing. There's this, and that is Luis de Silva from what? And he, is he? Where's he from? Chile? I can't remember. He basically insulted Biden right to his face at a podium, and Biden didn't notice. It's like he didn't even react. He didn't notice. He just didn't. You know, it's like. And so, anyway, all of a sudden, the mainstream press is starting to kind of turn on the president a little bit. But that said, our friend David Strom at HotAir.com, he ran this article, and we're going to post this on our blog, too, because I've seen few, David's a fantastic writer, and also, like me, he's really pissed off. Him and I have different mediums. He writes, I talk. But here's his article is called Liars, Nothing But Liars. You can go to HotAir.com, HotAir.com, and read this. And what he's talking about, or what the article is actually about, is Merrick Garland's testimony before Congress yesterday. Garland lies through his teeth. Just completely lies. I mean, you know, it's like if they were actually calling him on perjury for this, he'd easily be impeached. I mean, he's flat out lying. Now, I've always wondered what drives this guy, because he comes off as dishonest to the core. And I'm wondering if this is a guy, you know. The Republicans denied him a nomination to the Supreme Court during the Obama presidency. And I'm wondering if he's just driven by rage or revenge. I just wonder that, you know, that he decided, well, they fucked me, I'm going to fuck them. You know, who knows? He would have made a terrible. I mean, this is one of Mitch McConnell's crowning achievements from keeping him off the court, because he would have made a terrible Supreme Court judge. There's no doubt about it. But Strom brings this up, and there's no getting around at this point. At this point, this guy is either completely corrupt or grossly incompetent. Take your pick, and neither one of them is good. Anyway, I want to read for you a little bit here from David's piece. I'm going to read, and these are excerpts. I strung this together. This is not one block of it. He says, quote, this is David Strom talking here, writing, "As easily as Garland lies to Congress, the mainstream media outclasses him as shameless liars. I scoffed at Trump when he called the media the enemy of the people. He was right and I was wrong. I just thought they were biased. Now I understand that they are self-conscious liars. Their job, as they see it, is manipulating the people. In a few short years, the most sophisticated and pervasive propaganda machine in history has been created. It exists not to inform people, but to misinform them. I'm disgusted with a lot of them." That's David talking. "I'm disgusted with a lot of them. I'm disgusted by our political class, our cultural elite, our business leaders, and the whole lot of them. I haven't a clue who to trust. I can't even trust anything I read in a scientific paper." That was what David said. And he's right. We have the mainstream press has totally failed their mission. They are not, up till recently anyway, They're completely in the tank for the Democratic Party, and they won't comment negatively on anything the Democrats are doing. Nothing. Now, like I said, we are maybe seeing cracks, and I don't know if that's because the word has gotten out that they've decided Biden is unelectable a second time. I don't know. That might be. You know, I do not. These people, when I mean these people, I mean the leftists. I do not put anything past them. They do not do anything out of charity or the nature of their heart. They do it. It's all calculated. So I'm assuming that maybe, you know, I've said this before, and Tim Conaway, who's also running for president, who's a former magazine editor, edited like a dozen publications over his career, and he says I'm giving these people way too much credit for being smart. He said they're not that smart. But I still maintain this, that there's some secret online forum somewhere, private forum, where a lot of these left-wing journalists have access to, and that's where they discuss this stuff. Because if you know, I'm not the only person who noticed this. Sometimes shit goes down, and within minutes on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, within minutes, not only are people posting, but they're using the exact same wording. And that many people don't think that clear, that, you know, calculatingly in the same way. They don't. That's the reason I think that. It's basically they get on the forum, and somebody decides what they craft the message, and then it goes out. That's my, you know, okay, you, I'm a conspiracy theorist. But unfortunately, right now, most of my, you know, people are joking about this all the time. Most of my conspiracy theories are coming true. So, who knows? At any rate, I thought that would be a good segue into Dr. Moore's interview because, yeah, David says, I can't even trust anything I read in a scientific paper anymore. So you can trust this. And the thing is, if you read this book, I mean, seriously, it's like getting hit in the head with a brick. He so completely demolishes all the arguments that climate change is going to be disastrous that there's no way of getting around it. You have to read it. Now, unfortunately, no one, you know, I asked him at the end of the interview, you'll hear this, is this going to change? Is there anything we can do to change? Because right now, and I'm taking this full circle now, as with David Strom saying, the public is hugely misinformed on this, hugely. And so, you know, is anybody going to do anything different? I don't know. You know, I was listening to Joe Pags yesterday. I'm driving around 5-6 o'clock hour. He's on live here in the Twin Cities, 5 to 8 p.m., 6 to 9 on the East Coast. And I'm driving around, and I'm listening to him, and a caller asked him that. He said, you know, this is getting pretty discouraging. It's like all these people are lying for the proletariat, and how do we get a word in edgewise? How do we tell people this is all bullshit? Because the primary reason, I mean, as propaganda, this is working totally. I mean, my mother buys this hook, line, and sinker. She's 99 years old, but she's still sharp as a tack. And she believes if CNN says something, she assumes it's true. And it's complete, utter lies. Now, the thing is, that's been reflected in their viewership. I've talked about this before, and I might talk about this after the interview tonight, too. I'm going to give you a few minutes, an opportunity to call in, if you want to call in after this, after the interview's done. But CNN's ratings are, basically nobody's watching anymore, you know, except my mother, you know, and a few other people. But in the press world, in journalism, the Fourth Estate, CNN's watched a lot. And that's because they're a left-wing organ. I think CNN is more left-wing than even MSNBC is. And they have a declared bias. I have no problem with a declared bias. You know, people bitch and moan about Fox News, but we know what Fox News bias is. We know what MSNBC's bias is. CNN is extremely biased, and they will not for the life of them admit it. They still think they still call themselves an objective news source, and nothing could be further from the truth. That's where the original lie starts right there. I don't know what we're going to do about this, but what Peggs was saying is, you know, the caller asked him the same thing. He said, well, he said in his history, in his experience, what he's decided or learned that is you have to pound away on this stuff over and over and over again. And sooner or later, people start to get it. I had a friend of mine who worked as the assistant press secretary for Jesse Ventura when he was governor of Minnesota. Now, that's a whole... first of all, I'd love to get Jesse on the show. I don't know how to get a hold of him, and I might still try. I'd love to, because he's a fascinating guy. He did a pretty good job as governor. I think people thought he was going to be a transformational figure, and no, he didn't completely upend the government. He didn't, but he still did a pretty good job nonetheless. And I remember my friend who was worked in his press office said, she said, we've realized now that when we start putting out a message, as soon as about the time we get sick of pounding it, about that time the public just starts to catch on. And that's been my experience in the entertainment business too, is that you have to keep pounding and pounding and pounding until sooner or later people do start to notice. So, you know, okay, so the CNN's just noticed there's a border crisis. Well, it's been going on for 2.5 years. You know, you just noticed. Oh, that's great. You know, I can make an argument. You get paid to notice, you know, but whatever. All right, folks, we're going to go to our interview. This is Dr. Patrick Moore, co-founder of Greenpeace, climatologist, and author of this book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. I'm glad you're around to listen to this. Here we go. Joining us, Dr. Patrick Moore from Vancouver Island. Hi, Patrick. How are you doing?
Hi, Jim. It's a beautiful day here on the north end of Vancouver Island. Summer's still with us.
And you're a beautiful man, Patrick. And you have a lot of very important stuff to say. So I want to start with this, and I'm sure you're probably tired of telling this story, but could you tell our viewers how you were one of the co-founders of Greenpeace?
Well, Jim, I grew up in the wilderness of northern Vancouver Island on a floating logging camp, my dad's logging camp, in Winter Harbor. And I played in nature all my childhood. The forests, the tide flats, down the dock, catching fish, all that sort of thing. And so I had an innate love of nature from childhood. When I was sent to boarding school in Vancouver at age 14, I found the life sciences, biology, biochemistry, genetics, forestry, the whole works, and dove into that with great gusto. And then for first year university, I went into first year science. And then I decided I would go into forestry. That's the industry my family's been in for over 100 years.
And are that was still, a really... Are they still in it, Patrick?
No, we actually gave up our logging contract about 6-7 years ago because it wasn't worth it anymore. Uh-huh. Forestries get becoming very difficult in Canada because there's so many people who don't want anybody to cut any trees. And they've just made the regime really difficult. Some people are still doing okay, but there's a lot of land use problems. There's most of our forests are on public land. And so that means the politics comes into it. And we have, though, 140 acres of waterfront in Winter Harbor where the family has made it into a summer retreat. And I come here quite often, a year round. I come for a week at a time every now and again. I'm the landscape here, so I look after the brush, which is, believe me, grows 3 feet a year.
Is that because of more carbon dioxide?
Yes, it is, actually. You can actually see the increase in growth in this part of the world where there's plenty of water, there's lots of good soil. And the salmon berries and the salal and all the other weeds, as some people see them, although they have great fruits on them, they come up fast. And so you need a Honda weed whacker up here if you're going to keep them from coming in your window.
Anyway, I interrupted your story. Sorry, you're talking about
green. Yes, yeah. So while doing my PhD in ecology, which I did after my forestry degree, it was actually a combined forestry and biology with the science and forestry faculties. I went into an ecology PhD and really got into that because ecology still hadn't been used in the public press at that time, the word ecology. Environment was starting to be used a lot.
What year are we talking about, roughly?
1970, 69 to... And then in 71, in my second year in my PhD, I heard about this little group that called the Don't Make a Wave Committee that was starting to meet in the basement of the Unitarian Church in Vancouver. And we became Greenpeace, and I joined them even before the organization was named Greenpeace and sailed on the first voyage of Greenpeace against U.S. hydrogen bomb testing in Alaska. And we succeeded, of all things. We managed to get tens of thousands of people marching in the streets. And the day that bomb that we were protesting went off, a 5-megaton hydrogen bomb underground, people from both sides of the Canadian-U.S. border came and joined hands and blocked the border for some hours that day in solidarity with what we had done. We got on Walter Cronkite's Evening News, and not long after, President Nixon canceled the planned remaining nuclear tests. That was the second one, but there was going to be 5 or 6 more in the, mm-hmm. in the program. And that was the last hydrogen bomb test ever in the world. There were more atomic tests after that. Then we tackled French atmospheric nuclear testing, the only country really testing a lot of nuclear weapons in the air, because the other main nations had gone underground. So they were sending radiation all around the Southern Hemisphere. And New Zealand was particularly opposed to these French tests. So we used New Zealand as a base to go at nearly 2,500 miles from there to the Mururoa Atoll where they were testing their weapons. And so it was a big voyage to get there. But New Zealand sort of became the base for the protest. And when the Rainbow Warrior, our ship that we sailed later in 1985 into Auckland Harbor, French commandos, scuba divers went down and planted limpet mines on the hull of the ship while it was in the dock and sank it at midnight.
And was anybody on it?
Yes, there were a number of people still on it up in the galley. Some of the crew was at a pub nearby.
Did anybody lose their life?
Yes, the Fernando Pereira, the photographer, when the bomb went, there were two bombs placed, one midships to sink the boat by the engine room with a big compartment. The other one at the rudder propeller assembly to disable it permanently. Because if you smash that up, you're not going to be building an old boat again.
Right.
So Fernando was sleeping in the rear of the ship in the bunks at the back. And he went down to get his $10,000 worth of camera gear off the boat before it went down. And the second bomb went off about 1.5 minutes after the first one. And he was just down there. And it knocked him out and he drowned because the hull filled with water and he was unconscious.
That's sad.
Yes, they killed one of our people. And I guess that was along with the harpoon going over our heads out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean into a sperm whale. That went around the world. That was 1975. And this was 10 years later. We got the same sort of exposure and eventually, France stopped all its nuclear testing in French Polynesia.
So, hey, Patrick, let me ask you, why did they basically, forgive me for summing this up, for lack of a better term, why did they decide a bunch of students were so threatening? Why would you, I find this unbelievable that they actually blew up your boat. I mean, I just find this crazy.
It was orders from Mitterrand, come right down the chain. These were Navy SEALs equivalent who came and did this. And they were trying to do it without getting caught. But, we didn't know who did it at first.
How did you catch them?
Well, they left a small inflatable boat that had a label on it saying made in France.
I'm sorry, I should have laughed. This is not funny, but
no,
still.
No kidding, but that's how we found out. Like, and most of them got out through the airport before they were caught, but two of them were apprehended in the airport, and that caused a huge diplomatic row between France and New Zealand. France said they wouldn't buy any more lamb from New Zealand if they put them in jail, but they did put them in jail. But then 2 years later, they agreed to let them go to a French island nearby, and then they, a short time after that, they went back to France to a kind of hero's welcome. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's wrong with France that they thought that way or did those things.
Patrick, they're French.
I know the United States looks down upon them fondly.
So you were at Greenpeace at the beginning, and how long were you there?
15 years.
And why did you get out?
I got out because, in 1979, we created Greenpeace International, which now included New Zealand, Australia, France, Germany, Netherlands, England, UK, and other countries. And we had an international board of directors, of which I was one from I was actually the chief negotiator in this formation of Greenpeace International. Was basically the settlement of a lawsuit. The other groups that we created decided they would leave the parent organization and take all the money with it. And so we challenged them in San Francisco for copyright and trademark infringement. And the day before that was to come to court, they came forward to negotiate a settlement. And so we created a settlement which made me into one of the international directors. And David McTaggart, who was the leader of the Renegades, ended up becoming the chairman, which was fine with me at the time. We got our way. We didn't get all broken up into making Greenpeace into something that didn't have any meaning anymore, really, or no center. So as Greenpeace International, we moved forward in a number of really important campaigns. The campaign to stop whaling had been done prior to that. But then we stopped the slaughter of 250,000 baby seals nursing at their mothers off the coast of Newfoundland in the late 1970s. And then in the early 80s, we focused a lot on toxics. The United States and Canada had pretty good air and water pollution rules by this time. But Europe and the UK did not. Most of the rivers in Europe, the River Rhine, the River Elbe, and the Thames in Britain were basically dead because factories were still dumping their waste in pipes going underwater, so no one could see it happening.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm under the impression the Thames is still notoriously dirty, right?
No, there's lots of fish in it now.
Oh, there is. Okay,
yes,
good.
And most of the rivers have been returned to reasonable health because we took our what we called our river boat. It was a smaller boat than the ones we used on the ocean, which were like 150 foot. This was like a 75, 80 foot boat. And we went up the rivers and divers went down and plugged the pipes so that the waste backed up into the factories.
Oh, that's fun.
The newspapers liked that angle. And so we got a lot of publicity for doing that. And eventually much better and stringent rules were applied to waste dumping.
Hey, Patrick, let me ask you something. And this is not a loaded question. I'm a big fan of yours. Is there anything you did in Greenpeace that you regret?
Yes, I went along with the opposition to nuclear power, nuclear reactors. I didn't campaign against them, but I went. I didn't speak out because if I did, I'd be thrown out immediately. And that was definitely a wrong position. The environmental movement should have included nuclear energy with nuclear medicine rather than with nuclear weapons. It's a beneficial use of nuclear technology. And aside from Chernobyl, no one has died in a nuclear accident. And the Chernobyl accident was different for two reasons. First, they built this reactor design that could blow up.
Uh-huh.
And it did.
Yeah.
They had 25 others that didn't, but this one did. But it didn't do it during normal operating procedure. It did it when a group of physicists came down to do an experiment. And they ordered the operator to turn off the safety controls on the reactor. And it went critical and blew a 2,000-ton concrete lid off the top of it. And it took 10 days for the firemen to put the fire out. There was a big piece of carbon in there on fire. And that's like trying to put out an electric vehicle fire.
Yeah, really, really.
And they were all right next to the core of the reactor, these guys. And so about 80 of them eventually died from radiation poisoning. And then a few children who contracted thyroid cancer after the accident were not diagnosed early enough. If they'd been diagnosed early enough, they would have been fine. But there was about 5 or 6, I think.
And should we assume that if they did not take out the safety protocols while they're doing the experiment, it wouldn't have happened?
Well, I don't think they could do the experiment without doing that. I have no idea why they were doing it, to tell you the truth. But there is a lot of literature that is really detailed on what exactly happened there. if you take Three Mile Island as another nuclear accident, that was a nothing burger. I mean, there was nothing, nobody was harmed or hurt or nothing bad happened. They just ruined a reactor. So it was a nasty mechanical accident.
Well, I could make an argument that in the early 70s, nuclear power as a science was still kind of in its infancy, right?
No, it's nuclear science started way back in the 1920s, but
actually running the actual plants.
Yes, that was post-war, post-Second World War. The Manhattan Project involved creating a nuclear reactor, the Manhattan Project, to produce plutonium for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. The Hiroshima bomb was a uranium bomb. And some people believe that the reason they dropped two bombs was because they were two different types and they wanted to see what happened.
Right.
Well, they killed about 100,000 people in each one.
Yeah.
But we don't know for sure why they did that. They say it was because the Japanese hadn't surrendered yet after the Hiroshima bomb. And that's a credible answer too. So I think that it's coming now that nuclear energy will have a revival, because they're soon going to find out that their wind and solar fantasy is just that. And not only that, it's going to cost trillions of dollars wasted down the river.
And I'm under the impression that now, especially the French, because they use it so much, we've pretty much gotten rid of all the potential problems in nuclear power. Am I right about that?
Of course we have. We have over 100 reactors running between the United States and Canada, and no one has even been injured by radiation from them.
Yeah. Right.
And that's decades of operation.
Yeah, everyone just thinks
they are one of the safer. They're way safer than fossil fuels, and they're sure safer than EV batteries.
Yeah. So you tell me, why doesn't the green movement embrace this? It makes so much logic, but I guess logic is not the rule of the day here, is it?
Well, as you know, the title of my book is Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom.
Yes, right.
And radiation is invisible, so they can make any story they want about it, just like CO2. Those are the two key invisible things. The other invisible thing is whatever is bad in GMOs, and it's different because it doesn't actually exist, or if it did, it would have a name. And everything has a name if we know that it's there. And so they've got away with this anti-GMO campaign, raising billions of dollars, making it so Africa can't develop better strains for their people, and depriving Europe of it as well.
It's the craziest thing ever.
It's based on nothing.
Yeah, we've been altering the genetics of plants for thousands of years. It's just now we have a way of doing it a lot faster. I mean, Christ.
Well, not only that, with greater precision. That's one of the biggest parts of it, is we know exactly what genes are being placed into another species.
Right.
Genes have been moving between species all through the history of life. Bacteria carry them from one organism to another. And we have to remember that all of us, anything produced through sexual reproduction is genetically modified. We are not like our parents. We're not exact duplicates of our parents. We're a mixture. And so every single creature that is born through, and plants and animals and insects and everything else that is born through sexual reproduction is genetically modified. So they're using the term far too narrowly when all they mean is just one particular way of genetically modifying things.
I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but is the problem that these people don't want any change at all? Are they just completely resistant to any change?
Well, at the leadership, you got to remember there's the leadership and then there's the followers, right? And the followers are led to believe these things because I don't know why, but people are always worried about the future and scare stories about the future. Because the future is unknown and unpredictable. So if you can put fear into the hearts of people about something bad that's going to happen in the future, you can control them easier. And that's what this is all about, is really about control. that there's absolutely no evidence that carbon dioxide is anything like the control knob of global climate. It's a very minor player in a field of many factors. And in fact, with the CO2 Coalition, of which I'm a founding director and have been with it from the beginning, the CO2 Coalition believes that CO2 is entirely positive in its effects by increasing it in the atmosphere up to a level. It isn't even anywhere near the highest it's ever been in the history of the Earth. It's at 425 parts per million now, and it was 6,000 parts per million when life flourished back in the Cambrian period and the period of Carboniferous, when the forests were created, but because plants figured out how to make stems. And look at them now. They're 200-300 feet tall. And that all happened through periods when CO2 was far higher than it is now.
And you put in your book, you talk about the fact that if CO2 gets below 150 parts per million, basically everything dies, right?
Yes, and it got down to 180 in the most recent glacial maximum 20,000 years ago. When the oceans get colder, they absorb gases from the atmosphere. And when the oceans get warmer, they give off gases. So coming out of the most recent glaciation into this this Holocene interglacial period that we've been in now for about 10,000 years, the ocean gave CO2 and other gases back to the atmosphere and brought it up to 280 by the time we came along and started playing around. And now we've taken it from 280 to 425. And greenhouse operators all make it up to 800 to 1200 to get optimum growth of their plants. And you can you even get higher growth going up to 2000. But there's a financial issue that the higher you make the CO2, the less increase in growth there is up to a certain point.
Right. So you brought up in your book about the fact that a lot of the people, the climate change people say that even if the CO2 increases, that the food produced by plants is not necessarily any increase in nutritional value. But like you just brought this up, which is the reason I'm bringing up that basically greenhouses prove that's completely bullshit.
Yes, they do, because there's no evidence of that. But it's invisible. You see, the nutrition is invisible.
Yeah.
So they can just say that.
Right.
They say a lot of things that no one can see for themselves. If you can't see something for yourself, you're easily victimized by people who make scare stories out of it.
Yeah.
And lies. And this is also true for things that are remote. This is my universal theory of scare stories, that all of them are based on things that are either invisible to you or are so remote, like polar bears and coral reefs. That's why they are the icons, because the average person can't go and count the polar bears or see the Great Barrier Reef to its what extent it is.
Yeah.
But there's two things I can say. One about polar bears. When I was just in an audience of 500 very intelligent people, PhDs and geologists and all kinds of people. And I said to them, how many of you have heard of the treaty that was signed by all polar nations in 1973 to end the unrestricted hunting of polar bears? One person put up their hand. And that's usually about the same in any audience. Coca-Cola didn't tell anybody about that when they used the polar bears to get sympathy for their product. And so the truth is, polar bear population at that time was down to 6,000 to 8,000. And it was wildlife biologists that went to the governments and said, you've got to stop unrestricted hunting of polar bears because too many people can afford to go up there now in a plane and hire an Inuit guide and go and get some rugs for themselves. So that's what happened. And today there's between 30 and 50,000 polar bears and they're fat and happy. So, and also, It's good that some of the ice melts off the Arctic in the summer, because then the sun can get onto the Arctic water and grow the plankton for the krill, and they're eaten by the fish, that are eaten by the seals, that are eaten by the bears. So if the ice was covered 100% all year, there'd be hardly anything for the seals.
Yeah.
And so it's a kind of a perfect situation right now for polar bears. And the same with the Great Barrier Reef. They said in 2016 that 93% of it was dying. Well, that isn't dead, is it?
No.
or they said it was in its final terminal stage, as if there right. were other terminal stages before the final one, just to make it extreme statement. The truth is, last year they announced that the Great Barrier Reef had the largest extent of coral since they've been studying it intensively in the last 36 years. So it isn't dead, but not many people hear the good story. Most people heard the scare story back in 2016, 2017, when they said the coral reef was dying. And they use the word bleaching as synonymous with dying, whereas bleaching is just when the coral animal ejects the phytoplankton that is in symbiosis with it inside the coral, and then they choose a new one. And you'll often see, as you know, when I dive down in Mexico, there's one coral there that's really prominent, and you can tell what it's a staghorn coral, and some of them are green and some of them are brown. That's because they have absorbed different plankton species. Somehow or other, the thousands of little polyps that make up that are in the holes in the coral, each one a separate individual, all know which species of phytoplankton to absorb because they all absorb the same one. And they're right next to each other, these two corals. One's green, one's brown, even though they are the same species because they've absorbed different species of plankton. And somehow they can communicate to each other which one they should be absorbing. It's brilliant.
I've never gotten over how incredibly complex and wonderful life is. You know, it's amazing. I mean, you can call me a tinfoil hat person. On the show, we do a lot of stuff about UFOs and extraterrestrials. Now, supposedly in the government, they have dead extraterrestrial bodies, and amazingly, the people who have looked at them supposedly say they have DNA. It's not the same as our DNA, but a lot of scientists are now propagating the possibility that DNA may be universal across the universe. And that's mind-boggling. I mean, first of all, DNA is mind-boggling in the first place. I mean, it just is. You know?
Well, it's had 3.5 billion years to get to where we are now.
Yeah.
That's quite a long time. And so you have to remember that. It didn't happen overnight.
Right.
And although some people think the Earth is only 6,000 years old, but that's not true. My main point about this is that they say they have these bodies and DNA, and Tucker Carlson bought into it as well. There is, in fact, no actual proof that there is life anywhere else besides this planet. There's no actual proof of it. And they can't just, why don't they bring these other dead people out and show them to us?
That's a damn good question.
You know, I mean, they say this. So I don't listen much to what people say. I look and see if I can see it for myself. And even then, when you see something new, you shouldn't just take it at face value. As a metaphor, I say you should walk all around it and look at it from every direction you can, whatever it is you're looking at. And you'll get a better perspective than if you just see it from one angle, just from one perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, science is about observation. That is the very first step in science is observation. With your eyes, with other senses you have, with instruments like Geiger counters and microscopes and telescopes, you have to see it. Or at least know it, you know, feel it or something. You can't just make it up. And
that was clearly obvious from your book. I mean, your book is, it's very, very, your observations in your book are very, very prescient. I mean, I really admire you for doing that stuff.
Thank you. I think I have developed what you would call a logical mind. And I know that, see, some people think that science is just another thing. It's not. It's a special thing. It has to do with a very disciplined approach to discovery. The discovery comes at the end of the process. When you observe something, you say, oh, that looks pretty interesting. I wonder if that's a cause-effect relationship going on there. Then you repeat it over and over, and you try to eliminate any interfering other factors from what you're doing. And so you say, okay, I've got it. I have now verified that this is a cause-effect relationship because every time I do it, it's the same. And then you put it out into the public, and that's called replication. So there's observation, verification, and then replication by other people. And if other people take your work and get the same answer, you now have a theory. At first, it's just a hypothesis. But when you prove it through replication in the real world, whether the light gets bent but when it comes around the sun, for example, if you can show that 100 times, that the same thing happens every time, you've got a cause-effect relationship, and that is what science is all about, is finding out what causes what.
And speaking of cause and effect relationships, you mentioned in your book the fact, and I found this really fascinating, you said most people in the climate change bullshit area think you CO2 affects Earth temperature, and you said it's actually the opposite. Earth temperature affects the amount of CO2. Am I right about that?
Very much so. It's because of the oceans, which have nearly 50 times as much CO2 and other gases as the atmosphere does. And when the Earth warms, the ocean gives off CO2. And when the Earth cools, the oceans suck it up. Now, it's not that CO2 does not have a slight effect on the big mix, but it's such a small factor that almost any other thing can overrule it. That's why CO2 and temperature are out of sync more often than they are in sync through the long-term history of the Earth. Now, John Clouseau, is that right? He's a new director of our CO2 coalition. He won the Nobel Prize along with two others in 2022 for physics.
Mm-hmm.
He has really blown my mind. And, most things that I know about this subject, but when he, and I knew that clouds did, they bounce the solar energy back out into space. So if you have a really thick cloud and the sun hits it, most of the sun's energy will be bounced back to outer space, i.e. doesn't come down to warm the ground or the oceans. So he says that the percentage of the Earth is about 50% always covered with clouds, but it changes. So sometimes it might only be 40%, and other times it might be 60%. And that makes a huge difference to how much solar energy reaches the Earth, the surface of the Earth, the cloud, because the clouds are like a mirror bouncing it back.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is far more important factor than CO2, is the percentage of clouds. And then there's the solar cycles, which are also significant. So the climate catastrophists are trying to make it out that CO2 is the only thing we have to think about when we're thinking about climate, and that it's also a great threat to the Earth. The fact is, we are in one of the coldest periods in Earth's history right now. This is called Pleistocene Ice Age. We are in an interglacial period, one of 40, during this 2.5 million year Pleistocene Ice Age. Yeah, anybody can look it up. But the global warmists are acting as if the ice age is gone. No, it was just the most recent glacial maximum that took us into another interglacial period, no different than the previous interglacial periods. And in fact, it's still getting colder at the coldest.
I don't have to tell you this. It's
still getting lower at the lowest.
Patrick, there's a lot of scientists who have been saying the same thing, that relatively speaking, right now, the Earth is cold.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
and that's coming out now. There's a great graphic that was just printed that I'm about to put on my Twitter, and it shows that in recent sort of millions of years, we've been in one of the coldest periods in the history of the planet. Like before now. For 250 million years, there was no ice on the poles.
Mm-hmm.
The ice age that occurred 250 million years before now was the Karoo. It had lasted for 100 million years. This one we're in now is only 2.5 million years old. This one could last 100 million years too, although the Silurian Ice Age, which occurred before the Karoo, way back, you know, in something like 400 million years ago, that was quite a short one compared to the Karoo, but it was still longer than this one has been. So we're likely to be in this ice age with interglacial periods occurring regularly. Right now they're occurring on 100,000-year cycles for the last million years, so there's been 10 of them. Before that, they were on a 40,000-year cycle. We don't know exactly why it switched. That's called the Pleistocene conundrum by scientists. And scientists are quite willing to admit when they don't know the answer to something. That's another,
real scientists, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. That's another hallmark of science, is that if you haven't observed it, verified it, and had it replicated by other people, it's not science.
So, Patrick, I can't stress this enough to the people watching this. Your book makes an extremely complex subject basically as simple as possible, even though your book is not simple. I mean, it's like, you know, there's a little, you have to, you know, there's you have to basically kind of, there's charts and graphs in there, but you make it as absolutely as simple as possible, which I have to give you credit for. It's an extremely complex subject. Now, here's my, what is with these people who think that we have a government and we have officials who can barely understand anything, and they want, now they're talking about modifying the climate. That's, I mean, am I going to shoot myself? What the hell's going on here? This is bullshit.
Well, what's going on is you find out that a lot of billionaires are very narrow in their understanding of the world. They got there by one type of invention or another.
Right.
Bill Gates is my favorite example. He's a bonehead when it comes to this subject. He is the one who wants to put chemicals into the stratosphere to block the sun.
That's nuts.
But you know what his latest game is? He just gave $6 million to an outfit that wants to clear cut 70 million acres of forest, that's 10,000 square miles, and bury the wood in the ground. So that it can't rot and send CO2 back into the atmosphere, which the trees pulled out. So they're thinking that if we would take all the trees in the world and bury them in the ground and keep doing that every time one grew, that we wouldn't have any wood.
It's the craziest thing ever. People
don't seem to realize that wood is by far the most important renewable resource in the world. There's nothing comes close to it.
Right.
And yet that the Greens are basically against forestry.
I just find this just unbelievable. There's just, I don't know if you've ever, I've never actually seen it. There's a show on cable television called Snowpiercer, and it's about a dystopian future. And in that show, the dystopian future happens because governments try to change the climate and fail miserably at it.
Yeah,
well,
that would be the case.
Totally.
Leave well enough alone. Because right now, with the increase in CO2, we're getting the greening of the earth all around the planet. And there's nothing bad about that. That's a wonderful thing. The Earth is like, we are at the tail end of a 50 million year cooling period in this glacial age we're in now. The Eocene thermal maximum, just look it up. EOCENE, Eocene thermal maximum, was 50 million years ago when there was no ice on the Earth at all. The Earth was warm and the trees grew up way higher in the mountains than they grow now. Why people are in love with ice, I have no idea. It's how many species are there in Antarctica? Like about 5 species of penguins, and they depend on the sea for their food. There's nothing growing on the ice that they can eat.
Right.
Right. And people romanticize this for some reason.
Well, it's great for
martinis. The sea has already risen 400 feet coming out of the most recent glacial maximum. Some people call it the last ice age.
Yeah.
Which means it could be the final one. Last can not just be the most recent one, but also could be the final one. So they use that language because it isn't the ice age. It's just one of 40 interglacial periods within the ice age. And it's the most recent one, not the final one. We're actually on the way into the 85,000 year decline in global temperature into the next glacial maximum.
So if I could ask you to speculate for a second, there's a lot of scientists who are saying actually the real danger to the Earth is getting too cold, not too hot.
Well, it's already too cold in the sense that the poles are uninhabitable.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, for most species, the only species, like, people say that the polar bears are threatened by global warming, right? And by climate change. If it wasn't for climate change, there wouldn't be any polar bears, because if there wasn't any ice on the Arctic, which only happened, you know, it started about 3 million years ago, but it wasn't like it is now until a very short period of time in Earth's history, maybe, a million years, say. And it was the Eurasian brown bear that turned into a polar bear, because the ice came and Eurasian brown bears could go out on the ice and hunt seals, and they turned into polar bears over hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. They can still mate with the brown bear, which we call grizzly bears. They are an old world species, but they came here across the Bering Land Bridge during these glaciation periods, glacial maximums in this Pleistocene. Before that, there was no way of getting across, because until the Pleistocene Ice Age happened, there was no land bridge, because right. there was no ice age.
Right. And so
the bears, the only reason polar bears exist is because of climate change, getting colder.
Uh-huh. And you had ancient humans basically walking from Russia to Alaska, right?
They did, indeed. And it was 15,000 years ago when the sea was still nearly 400 feet lower than it is today. And you think of coral reefs. They say they're going to die because of the sea rising a few feet, and it's going to drown all the Pacific islands. The corals have grown up and down 400 feet 40 times during this Pleistocene Ice Age. When the sea goes down, the corals have to go down with it. Corals can't grow 40 feet up in the atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
So, and then when the sea comes back again, another comes 400 feet, they have to grow up with it. That's why there's so much limestone in the world today. Part of the reason. Limestone is made from shellfish, including corals. And that's what's resulted in the CO2 going from 6,000 ppm 500,000 years ago. Sorry, 500 million years ago, to what it is today, had gone down to 180 from 6,000. That's almost all been caused by the formation of fossil fuels. That's a very minor part of it. It's the shellfish and the calcium carbonate made from calcium and carbon dioxide in the sea, where they have sucked it out of the living system of flowing through life. They've sucked it out and put it in the sediments at the bottom of the sea, where it's turned into limestone, marble, and chalk. The White Cliffs of Dover are made from the skeletons of microscopic coccolithophores, which are a phytoplankton, in other words, a plant that photosynthesizes and is at the base of the food chain in the oceans. But 100 million billion tons of carbon as carbon dioxide have been turned into calcium carbonate by shellfish making protective plating for their bodies, like clams and mussels and barnacles and crabs and all the many, many species, and corals are 50% of it. Mm-hmm. over the millennia. This takes taken millions and millions of years for them to do this. But when marine life figured out how to make armor plating for itself out of calcium and carbon dioxide, it presaged the end of life. They didn't
Say that again.
It presaged the end of life, because it had got down to 180 during the most recent glacial maximum.
Okay.
And then we come along and start replenishing it.
Right.
No other species could have come and replenished it. It was going to keep going down.
Yeah.
And it would only be a 2 or 3 more 100,000 year periods when it would go down below 180.
Right.
And then things would start to die.
Right.
And then it would warm up. And it would go back up again for a period of time, and whatever hadn't died would flourish somewhat. And then it would eventually go down to where it never came back up above 150, and that would be the end of life. And that would be maybe a million years from now, but that's a blink in nature's eye.
Yeah.
So we came along. We are actually the salvation of life on Earth, because no other species could have figured out how to use the fossil fuels and put the CO2 back in the atmosphere again. You see, most people don't realize that the fossil fuels we are emitting all came from the atmosphere and the ocean in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And were lost to the cycle. That's why it has continuously declined. We're lost to the cycle in sediments on the land. The coal is all made from forests that have become buried. And most of that happened in the Carboniferous period, 300 and some million years ago. And the in the sea, the shellfish have been responsible for 90% of the loss of carbon dioxide. Again, there's 50 times nearly as much CO2 in the oceans as there is in the atmosphere. And that wasn't the case when the atmospheric CO2 was 6,000 ppm, but it was still nowhere near as much as was in the oceans, because they're at equilibrium on the surface. You got to remember, the oceans cover nearly 3/4 of the Earth's surface.
Right.
And the atmosphere and the oceans are contacting each other at that interface. And there's an exchange of gases between the two, depending on the temperature of each. And there's a law that's written down. I forget its name right now. But there is a physics formula for this exchange of gases between the... I've almost got it, but it's back in my mind there somewhere.
You said in your book, if I get this right, so correct me if I don't, that there's about an 800-year lag between the temperatures of the ocean matching the atmosphere, or is what's it, the transfer of CO2 from the oceans to the atmosphere and vice versa? Do I got that right?
That's right. In other words, the cause-effect relationship is that the temperature causes the CO2 to change.
Right.
The temperature of the ocean. And the temperature of the ocean is dependent upon the cycles of warming and cooling of the Earth.
Yeah.
Which during the Pleistocene Ice Age, it's a miraculous situation that first there was the 40,000-year cycles, and then there was the 100,000-year cycles. And these are in sync with the Milankovitch cycles, which are based on Jupiter's gravity. The gravitational effect of Jupiter causes changes to the temperature of the Earth by changing the tilt of the Earth. The tilt is now 21 or so degrees. It changes by a two plus degrees in that 40,000-year cycle. And the 100,000-year cycle is how
the orbit of the Earth around the sun.
Orbit of the Earth around the sun. Yeah.
Right.
It changes shape in 100,000-year cycles.
Yeah.
And so those are pretty well, I mean, if it isn't a cause-effect relationship, it's an awfully amazing
coincidence?
Yes.
Yeah.
Coincidence. It's not a coincidence.
It's not a coincidence.
Too regularly.
Well, a lot of people have, you know, have propositioned that the global temperatures are based on the Earth revolving around the sun, but what is the guy? Malkovich is the name?
Milankovitch, Eastern European physicist
who
discovered this in the 1920s, but it wasn't until we had more sophisticated instrumentation that we could kind of see, it's in the same cycle as these cycles of the planet.
And it's basically like the effects of the tides of the moon, except it involves the whole solar system, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, look what the moon does with its gravitational effect, and the sun. Between the two of them, the moon is the most powerful player there, but the sun is a big factor too. And when they come into sync with each other or opposite each other, it's interesting because even when they're opposite, the tides are higher and or lower depending on the season. I still don't know the answer to why the winter tides are higher than the summer tides.
Uh-huh.
Here, at least in the northern hemisphere. But it's when the sun is tilted towards, when the Earth is tilted towards the sun, is the summer.
Uh-huh.
So I guess it's more of a direct line from the gravitational effect of the sun. The moon also moves up and down in the sky.
Because I'm crazy.
If you watch it carefully, sometimes it's lower and sometimes it's higher.
Yeah.
And so all of these, the moon and the sun are by far the main influence on the tides. But when it comes to these Milankovitch cycles, they are in sync with Jupiter, which is the largest planet and, you know, has a huge gravitational effect, but it's a long, long way away.
Right, it is. Comes
to certain positions, it has this effect on the Earth.
So to wrap this all up here, if you don't mind me asking, and you're a scientist, so you don't normally do this, I'm going to ask you to speculate. What do you think is going to happen with this whole climate change phenomena? I mean, you know, I've read your book and I've read other people's books. And I came to the conclusion. Matter of fact, if you don't mind me ending here with a little story, if I'll do a little talking, if you don't mind. I'm glad you're talking. That's why we're doing this. But I mean, you might find this interesting. About 10 years ago, I ended up at the Christmas party of a very large scientific institution. I'm not going to tell you why I was there. I don't want the public to know, that sort of thing. So I'm at the bar with this guy, and this guy's not famous to the public, but he's one of the premier climatologists in the United States. I'm guessing you probably know who he is. And we're sitting there, and frankly, we're getting a little drunk. And we're drinking. I said, Professor, tell me about climate change. And he slammed his drink down on the bar and said, yeah, I'll tell you about climate change. It's complete and utter bullshit. And he went on a 20-minute monologue about how this was complete crap. And he also, he threw in some scientific jargon, but I was a little too drunk to understand. But what he did mention, he said, we have to pay attention to it in my profession, because if we don't get any money for any funding at all. We can't fund anything.
That's right.
And
the politicians are in charge of who gets money for science research, almost all of which is done in universities these days. And the journals that publish their stuff are journalists, which they used to be scientists in charge of the scientific documents, but they're not anymore. They're journalists, and they have taken it over. And the politicians and their bureaucrats have taken over who gets the money. That's the quiet part. Then they come out with this paper saying that CO2 is definitely the cause of this or that. And that gets the megaphone of the media and the activists. And that's what we're stuck with. Almost as if we're hoisted by our own petard with regard to so much communication being possible that people are using it to scare each other and to indoctrinate people into being foot soldiers for a movement that is totally bogus. We are not in charge of the global climate, and we shouldn't be in charge of it, because what we would hope is that this Pleistocene ice age does end one of these times and the poles become green again, like they were for most of the history of life. This is a cold period. They say that the coral reefs are threatened by warm seas in Florida right now. The warmest oceans in the world have the highest coral biodiversity. It's called the Coral Triangle. It's in Indonesia, Philippines, and Solomon Islands. I'm going there for the third time this November to snorkel with 600 plus species of coral and 2,200 species of reef fish.
But
the second warmest ocean in the world is the Caribbean. In the 50,000 years that the Earth has been cooling out of the Eocene thermal maximum, they have lost 50% of their species because it got colder. If the Earth warms, even considerably, as it was in the Eocene thermal maximum, that's not going to happen anytime soon. But say if it did, coral would spread far wider than it is today. Coral likes warm water. It's not like it's boiling or anything or going to burn you if you get in it. 30 degrees, 35 degrees Celsius. Our bodies are 36 degrees inside. And we want it to be cold out? No, we don't want it to be cold.
I don't know if you saw this, Patrick, but the general of the Secretary General of the UN literally said this week, he said the era of global boiling has begun.
Yes, I know. Yeah, global boiling.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Our bodies are 36 degrees Celsius. Boiling is 100 degrees Celsius. So basically three times that much. And of course, we don't want the oceans to boil, but there's no possibility of that happening. There's a possibility that we might get 1 or 2 degrees of warming, but it appears more likely. We're about 300 years into this warming period, which is a cycle that started 6,000 years ago.
Yeah, and you do say in your book that over the last 300 years, the Earth has warmed about 1 degree Celsius. Is that right?
That's right. And the first half of that, we weren't using any fossil fuels, and it warmed at the same rate after we started using fossil fuels as it did before.
Right.
All these graphs are easily obtainable, but my book is even more easily obtainable from Amazon.
Yes.
Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of...
We'll have a link to it on our blog. And I can't tell you how many copies I've bought and given to people. It's like, there's no better argument to the BS of climate change than your book. That's what I think. And God bless you for writing it, because only you could describe it in such... It's like I said, it's an extremely complex subject, and you make it as simple as possible, which no offense, it's not simple, but you made it as simple as possible. I think that's quite an achievement. I really do.
I believe that any grade 9 student who has studied science to some extent will have no difficulty reading my book.
I agree.
When I use a big word, I explain what it means.
Right. If you graduated from high school, you should be able to read this. That's right. I agree. Totally. You know.
Oh, there's no doubt if you've graduated from high school and you've taken some science that you'll be able to read everything in the book.
Yeah.
And there's lots of references. If somebody who read the book went and looked at every single reference I give, you would know an awful lot about climate on this earth. And and most of it is contrary to what the scare people are telling us.
Yeah.
There's nothing to be afraid of, except for hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, and droughts. They've been happening since the beginning of time, and we're not going to do anything to end them.
That's like what my wife talks about. We living here in Minnesota. I mean, winters here are terrible. They're just awful. But she says at least we know what's coming. It's pretty much the same every year, you know. So
pretty much. And people who are young didn't live through the 1960s. When I was a kid, there was a cold period then, quite a lot colder than now.
Yes, absolutely.
And snow lasted much longer for 10 to 15 years during that period. And Time Magazine and all the other publications were saying that we're going into an ice age.
That's right. They were. I remember that too. My mother's 99 years old, and she talks about all the time about the fact that in the 60s, winters were way worse than they are now. You know,
and in the 30s, it was warmer than it is now. There were many more days over 100 degrees in the mid-1930s than there have been since.
Yeah.
In this modern warm period.
Right.
Which we call it. See, there was the Minoan warm period 3,000 years ago, then a cooling. Then the Roman warm period 2,000 years ago, then a cooling into the Dark Ages, which were not much fun. And then a warming into the medieval warm period when the Vikings colonized Iceland and were growing crops there. Sorry, Greenland. They also called Iceland at that time too. That was the medieval warm period 1,000 years ago. Then 500 to 600 years ago was the Little Ice Age, which was the coldest it's been since the beginning of this 10,000 year Holocene. I forget the name all the time. This is the Holocene climate optimum.
Yeah.
And see, it was warmer back then, because when you come out of the glacial maximum, it goes up and stays warm. It stayed warm for about 4,000 years, and then it started down again. And like the Sahara was green from side to side 8,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then
that's not that long either.
It started, no, it isn't. It civilization began in earnest about 10,000 years ago.
Right.
As we got warmer coming out of the Holocene interglacial period. And so now we have been in a slow decline with warming and cooling, warming and cooling, warming and cooling. But the Little Ice Age was the coldest it's been since the beginning of the Holocene interglacial period. And now we're in a slight warming period. 1 degree Celsius in 300 years.
Yeah. And everyone's panicking.
Yes. And that's going to end in 200 years if it follows the same pattern. You can't predict the future, because even though you see a pattern that goes for 10,000 years, that's only 10,000 years, and then that pattern can end for some other reason. And this whole thing about people being able to predict into 2100 what the climate is going to be is balderdash. We can predict the weather a few days out because we can see it coming.
Yeah. Right? And also, we've only been able to do that for like 20 years. You know?
Now we have early warning systems for hurricanes and for snowstorms. And, you know, and there's 100 times less people dying now than were 100 years ago by population.
And you bring up in your book about the fact that the problem of all the computer models with climate change or actually anything is that we actually don't have enough data to plug into these models to get accurate results because the damn thing's so damn complicated.
Well, it's not only that. You can't get data that's in the future.
Yeah, that's true too, right.
You know, even the IPCC has said twice in their documents, but they never let it out. They say, because the climate is multifaceted, in other words, lots of different factors, nonlinear, in other words, you can't just do it with a straight line on things.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important, chaotic. Chaos is unpredictable. That's the meaning of chaos.
Yeah.
Is that you can't see through it into the future. And so that's why we can't predict the future, because the Earth system and the planets and all the rest of it are chaotic. And they don't go in all just regular patterns.
Patrick, I clipped that quote out of your book, and it's important to mention that quote. They said that in May of 2018. It was only 5 years ago. That quote you actually mentioned about the nonlinear chaos.
Yes, that was the second time they mentioned it. They mentioned it in 2001 and again. But they purge it, basically. They refuse to recognize it, and then they go ahead and predict the future. And my simple statement is the crystal ball is a mythical object.
Mm-hmm.
We have no crystal ball to predict the future. Computers put back out the result of what you put in. We call it GIGO in the old days, garbage in, garbage out.
Right.
Right. And so we can put all the knowledge we want into a computer, but the computer cannot predict the future with that. Neither can we. I mean, it is what we have created. The computer is a marvelous tool, but it can't predict the future just like the crystal ball can't.
So, Patrick, let me end with this. Why do you think humans are so arrogant? Why do we think we can always change everything? I mean, I just find this amazing.
Self-importance is an amazing thing, isn't it?
It is.
My late brother Michael always said that pride is the only sin that can be disguised as a virtue. In other words, people think they're better than other people, right? And
uh-huh.
they pump themselves up. And a lot of these climate catastrophists are in that category, thinking they're better than other people. And they're rude and crude and should be glued.
A little alliteration there. I like that. Do you see any end in sight? And now I'm asking you to speculate politically. I look at this as the biggest single grift proposed to the American public and probably ever. Do you find any end to this? Do you think this is going to turn around? I mean, you know, I put you on TV because I figure if we pound this enough to the public, sooner or later, maybe they'll get some of it. Do you think that's going to happen or when? Or
I don't know how far this can go, but when people find out that the wind and solar thing is just a scam and it's not going to work, electric vehicles fine, but it's so stupid to say that you can't buy any other kind of vehicle.
Right.
I mean, I live at the end of a 45-mile gravel road here when I'm up in Winter Harbor, and I'm not bringing an EV in here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just not going to do it.
Also, I don't know if you share my opinion on this. I think particularly the wind thing is complete bullshit. I mean,
well, not only that, it's killing hundreds of thousands of birds and bats.
Right. That's one of the things. It kills millions of birds.
It's threatening to kill the whales off the East Coast, off the Atlantic coast.
Yeah. I know.
Following that.
I think
the government is giving out permits to the wind people to let them kill whales if they do.
Yeah.
They call it, they've got a name for it that doesn't sound like dead, but it is. And so they take, that's right. They use the word take. Take a whale. If you take a whale, it means you killed it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Say, that sounds good. Right.
Yeah.
That sounds really antiseptic. That's
taking
good.
Taking a whale for dinner.
I think that, 50 years from now, these windmills are just going to be considered relics of the stupid past. This is a
it will be less than that, Jim.
Yeah, I hope you're right.
That. I call it, I say, may they rest in peace.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Thank you. I'm going to use that. I hope you don't mind.
No, it's a good one. You use it.
Patrick, it's really nice talking to you. I really appreciate this. I can't tell you. Well, we're going to put your book up on the blog. I'm going to talk this up. Because, I think that book is brilliant. It's brilliant in its simplicity about how you took I've said this three times already. You took an extremely complex subject and made it as simple as can be made. And in that sense, you have my props, man. It's like,
well, thanks for helping spread the word, Jim. I really appreciate it because everybody should know these things.
Yes, they should.
And it's easy to know by reading my book because I don't make it complicated on purpose like some people do.
No, you don't. That's right. That's the beauty of it. You're a great writer and a great scientist, and God bless you. It's like, we appreciate it. I really appreciate what you're doing. So
thanks very much for letting me have a good run at it here, Jim. That was nice of you.
That's cool. That's good. We'll talk to you soon, Patrick. I hope you take care of yourself, all right?
Anytime. Let's take it up. There's lots more to talk about.
Yes, there is. There is. Okay, thank you. Thanks. I will do that. We'll be in touch soon. Take care.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Patrick Moore from Vancouver, Washington. I watched the whole thing just right now with you. I got to admit, I just think he's fantastic. And getting back to what we were talking about before we ran the interview, the press in the United States now lies regularly, but there's no bigger lie anywhere than this thing about catastrophic climate change. I mean, I hope you heard this guy talk about the scientific aspects of this, and like I said, you have to read his book. You really do. It will, if you think that I'm full of shit here, you read his book and it will change your mind. And there's not a lot of stuff on the horizon that changes people's minds now, but you can't refute this. He knows what he's talking about, and it's all crap. The whole thing is just complete bunk. He also mentions, I don't know if you got the part where I talked about the extraterrestrial DNA, and he kind of blew me off because he said, well, that's all speculation. Of course, he's a scientist and I speculate for a living. That's what I'm doing here, but it did remind me. I read something, I can't remember where it was, people who say they've been abducted, a few people apparently have. Now, I don't know if you know about the abduction scenario, but apparently it's pretty clinical until the quote-unquote medical the medical examination is over, at which point, a lot of the people who've been abducted say their captors kind of warm up a little bit and will even answer questions. And several of them have asked questions like, what do you think of our planet? And supposedly, the almost the universal answer to that question is, your planet is too damn cold. And Charles Hall, who wrote a series of books about his time in the Air Force at Nellis Air Force Base, where he said they set up a special secret base for extraterrestrials to land at. I mean, you got to read these books, because the thing is, he's either completely telling the truth, or he's the best novelist on the planet. There's not a lot of room either way here. But he said that those extraterrestrials also told him that the thing they hate about most about the Earth is that it's too damn cold. So it's like, I just kind of find that funny. I was going to go on here and talk about some other stuff and wait for your phone calls, but I'm sorry, I'm not going to take your phone calls tonight. I want to leave that the way it was. I thought that was pretty damn cool. Next week we have at least one guest coming up for the Republican debates on Wednesday. As I said, we're going to go live as soon as the debate's done, but that it should be done around our normal starting time of 11 p.m. Eastern. That's what it looks like right now. But whenever it is, we're going live. You know, I got a couple other people coming on too. I don't like to name guests until we actually have them booked for a specific day. I will tell you though, today we booked UFO investigator Stan Gordon for January 18th, and that I'm actually looking forward to that. I mean, this guy's been around the world a zillion times on this, very very well known. So, and he says he has a lot to talk about. He said we can do 90 minutes if we want. I don't really want to do that, but well, you know, I mean, this was 65 minutes. I don't know if you noticed that, you know, and Patrick's willing to come back, so that's really good. I appreciate it. So I hope you folks have a good weekend. I got a lot of work to do. Stuff here kind of never ends, you know. On Monday, we're going to start broadcasting live on Spreaker Live. I will explain that at the top of the show on Monday, and we'll put a thing on our blog on that too. About we've switched podcast hosts, so the thing is, and now some of our this is our 22nd show. About of the 18 previous show, the first 18 shows, we put 6 of them up on Spreaker. They're ones with guests mostly. And from now on, all of them will be on Spreaker archive. So either they will be available as podcasts, and apparently they're going to go out, you know, the idea is they go out wherever you get your podcasts ever because of RSS. So you'll be able to listen only, not watch, on the Spreaker app. And then if you want to, address or, you know, access the audio only, it's fine. Like I said, I know not a lot of you are going to be interested in this, but it was just kind of really important to me, basically because of my pedigree and history, that we make at least one audio feed available. So there you go. That started on Monday. So I'm going to have a really good weekend. I hope you have a really good weekend. Good night, Uncle Donnie, wherever you are. And once again, now you get to hear, we're going to play our new, here's our new end card title stuff. Here we go. We'll see ya. The following program contains you. Wrong one! What am I doing? Here we go.